RN, your world unfolding.
Hello and welcome to Big Ideas here on RN and online at abc.net.au. Paul Barclay with you. Thanks for joining me. Remember, you can download Big Ideas from our website or subscribe to us via iTunes. Tonight, what history might tell us about Indigenous disadvantage, the 2013 Geoffrey Bolton Lecture. This lecture is hosted by the State Records Office in WA and aims to provide an archival and historical context to national debate on contemporary issues. This year's speaker is Professor Marcia Langton, Foundation Chair in Australian Indigenous Studies at the University of Melbourne. She's looking at how past decisions by governments, as recorded in archives, have created the historical, political, and social causes of Indigenous disadvantage. With specific reference to the Cape York Peninsula, she recounts how these decisions entrenched barriers to the economic advancement of Aboriginal people in the region. In particular, she draws on Professor Geoffrey Bolton's own contribution to our understanding of the history of Cape York in his book from the early 1960s, A Thousand Miles Away, A History of North Queensland to 1920. Marcia Langton argues governments again and again used environmental and conservation laws to prevent Aboriginal groups from acquiring and using land. She also maintains recent government decisions continue to affect the economic and social well-being of traditional owners. Here's Marcia Langton with the 2013 Geoffrey Bolton Lecture.
At some time in the early 1990s, as I researched the historical factors that shaped the lives of the Aboriginal people of Cape York Peninsula, I discovered one of Professor Bolton's books, A Thousand Miles Away, published in 1970 about the settlement of Far North Queensland. In 1993, I moved to Cairns in Far North Queensland to commence employment with the newly created Cape York Land Council, which aimed to represent the traditional owners of Cape York Peninsula in their desire for appropriate ownership of their lands and a controlling interest in their future. It was my role to initiate, research, administer and manage land rights and native title claims, land purchases, and to participate in other projects as instructed by the Executive Director, Noel Pearson. From 1995 to 2001, I continued to visit the area to research, among other things, the traditional ecological knowledge of the peoples of the Leura Basin, especially in relation to their use of fire to manage their estates. I have remained involved periodically since, serving as the chairman of the Cape York Institute for Policy and Leadership from 2004 to 2009. I worked extensively with people who were born in the Princess Charlotte Bay region, from Cape Melville to Port Stewart, and inland to Leura and nearby places. They had been stockmen and women at various times in their working lives and had travelled into the remote areas on foot and on horseback. They did not own or have access to vehicles for private use until the 1970s and 1980s. Even after they had obtained vehicles for their private use, they did not have legal access to the national parks until the 1990s, although in such remote areas, their travels across their traditional lands went undetected by the authorities. I learnt a great deal from the elders of the Yimadir, the Lama Lama, the Aluaya or Gugutai Band, and the people of Barrow Point, among others, who owned many hundreds of countries, named tracts or sites, including streams, swamps, lagoons, certain salt pans and sand ridges, islands and reefs. Here I can only provide the briefest of pictures of their extraordinary world. At that time, environmental campaigners from southern cities were building a campaign to have large areas of the region declared national parks. Although they gave the impression that they intended to be allies of the Aboriginal traditional owners seeking restitution of their lands, it became clear that a conflict between these purposes was inevitable. The non-Aboriginal environmental campaigners regarded the peninsula as a wilderness to be protected from human interference, while for its Aboriginal inhabitants and custodians, this was their country, consisting, as I say, of hundreds of named places inherited from their ancestors over thousands of years. And most importantly, these were their homelands. The traditional owners could walk the boundaries of their homelands, and despite the radical changes to their traditional economic and social life that followed colonisation and enforced settlement, they maintained their traditions of property relations in their estates and ancient land management practices in their territories. They had a vision for their future. They engaged with the consequences of the changes that resulted from the settler colonisation of their world and continued to practice rituals and customs that inscribed places with sacred meaning and historical memory and expressed the legitimacy of their tenure. They continued reckoning their descent from ancestral figures, to speak their languages and to undertake their traditional land use and management practices. Urban environmentalists in Australia have had a sustained romance with a few special features of the homelands of these peoples. The wet tropics, wetlands and magnificent rainforest areas that are located in the mountainous areas of North Queensland. In their campaigns for the protection of these areas, they have typically used photographic imagery that emphasised these features over the equally beautiful grassy plains studded with tall termite mounds and other ecological zones that fail to meet their aesthetic standards. Cape York Peninsula is indeed a marvellous region. This vast, broad, triangular peninsula landform was shaped when the sea level rose and eventually stabilised some 5,000 to 6,000 years before the present, to a level close to that of today, when the late Pleistocene, early Holocene sea level rise flooded the broad pericoastal continental shelf and changed it from a terrestrial plain to a shallow and rich marine ecosystem, now part of the Great Barrier Reef province. The region's rainfall is high, but decreases in reliability along a gradient from north to south. The southeastern coast of the peninsula is a rain catchment area, a result of the Great Dividing Range, which runs like a spine from the northeast central area of the peninsula and onwards down the southeastern coast. This area, then, with the highest peaks and ranges, has the highest rainfall in the region and supports the areas of tropical rainforest that fascinate the naive environmental campaigners. These tropical rainforests are often impassable and dense. The wet tropics are confined to a chain of non-contiguous areas along the eastern slopes of the Great Dividing Range. River systems are formed by the water flows in the upper reaches of the ranges and traverse both the eastern and western coastal plains. Much of the peninsula is covered by plains and sclerophyll forest typical of the northern savannas because of the distinctive annual climatic pattern of a wet monsoonal season followed by a dry season. The heaviest rainfalls are from January to late March, early April. The plains of Cape York are frequently inundated. Several elders explained to me that Aboriginal groups in the region recognise six seasons in contrast to the common understanding of a wet and a dry season. Due to its length and progressive narrowness, the peninsula provides an extraordinary length of coastline in proportion to its area, and because of this geography, the great majority of Aboriginal populations inhabit the coastal margins, where the great variety of habitats, riverine, marine, wetland and rangeland provide a wealth of resources. For its Indigenous owners, the climatic conditions, the seasons, their fire regime and traditional economic practices combine to produce a lifestyle that is, for some periods of the year, still maintained. Peoples such as the Lama Lama and Noel Pearson's Yimitir people have proved that they are resilient. And as descendants of the people whose involvement in the events I describe, extraordinarily determined to maintain their societies as viable propositions in a much-changed world. The transformation of these Indigenous societies in the 19th and 20th centuries were in large part the result of the colonial and post-colonial strategies of dispossessing and controlling the native peoples to enable the establishment of a colonial economy and governmental regime in the northernmost area of the colony of Queensland. A special administration of native affairs in the 20th century consolidated the economic hold of a class of settler cattle graziers or pastoralists, and the expansion of a nature conservation land management regime, tourism and mining into the area. This control was achieved over many decades by military as well as administrative means. Following the violent early frontier wars, both the colonial and post-federation governments removed thousands of Aboriginal people from their homelands in the region to administered settlements, such as the prison settlement on Palm Island. The aspirations of the peoples of Cape York for land restitution in the 1990s challenged government policy and attitudes in Australian society. Even at this stage of history, that Aboriginal people should want to reside in their traditional homelands and re-establish viable communities was anathema to the white settler community. Their white neighbours were accustomed to the impoverished situation of Aboriginal people and their exclusion from social and economic life, and were distinctly uncomfortable with the new discourse of Aboriginal rights that was taken up by Aboriginal leaders throughout Cape York Peninsula during their campaign to establish the Cape York Land Council. Successive Queensland governments used environmental conservation legislation and instruments to prevent Aboriginal groups from acquiring and using land. The most notorious of such actions was that taken against the late John Kawata of the Winchanum group of the western side of Cape York Peninsula, following his attempted purchase with the assistance of the Aboriginal Land Commission of the Archer River pastoral holding, located on his traditional territory. In February 1976, Kawata and the Aboriginal Land Commission entered into a written contract with the lessees for the purchase of the lease and cattle and horses there. The sale and transfer of the lease was subject to the approval or permission of the Minister for Lands of the State of Queensland, and on 23 March 1976, the Commission sought the consent of the Queensland Minister for Lands to the transfer of the lease to the Commission. The Minister refused to grant consent or permission to the transfer. On or about 8 December 1976, the Minister for Lands stated the reason for refusing to grant approval or permission to such transfer. The statement contained the following passage. The question of the proposed acquisition of Archer River pastoral holding comes within the ambit of declared government policy expressed in Cabinet decision of September 1972, which stated, the Queensland Government does not view favourably proposals to acquire large areas of additional freehold or leasehold land for development by Aborigines or Aboriginal groups in isolation. In the light of this policy, the recent development whereby the Aboriginal Land Fund Commission sought to acquire by transfer Archer River pastoral holding was reported in detail to State Cabinet, whereupon Cabinet said in June 1976 that Cabinet's policy regarding Aboriginal reserve lands as approved in 1972 remains unchanged, that in accordance with such policy and as it is considered that sufficient land in Queensland is already reserved and available for the use and benefit of Aborigines, no consent be given to the transfer of Archer River pastoral holding to the Aboriginal Land Fund Commission. Kawata's appeal to the High Court was successful. The High Court overruled the Queensland Government's action on the grounds of, among other things, racial discrimination with costs. However, Kawata and the Winchanum group were never able to acquire title to their beloved country. The Queensland Government had gazetted the lease area as a national park. Later, such government strategies deployed to suppress Aboriginal customary land affiliations and associated aspirations relied to a significant extent on the demands of the populist environmental movement for the protection of wilderness, or areas of great natural beauty with little colonial or human impact. Some of the non-government environmental organisations which pursued this aim were motivated by plainly racist assessments of the impact of Aboriginal people on these remote areas, and sought likewise to suppress Aboriginal affiliations with their traditional lands in that region. Their motives were often self-serving as well, particularly on the part of recreational groups involved in national park use and fishing, the members of which expressed the unsubstantiated views that their usage would be curtailed if national parks and other conservation areas were owned or managed by Aboriginal people. The appropriation of huge areas of land continued until the 1980s under various legislative and executive actions which enabled the granting of titles and interests, particularly pastoral leases and national parks, over any areas in which Aboriginal groups expressed an interest, whether as a location for their resettlement or for the continuation of social, economic and cultural activities. Access to parts of the region is extremely difficult, and in other parts not well served by roads. As the final submission by the Cape York Land Council to the Aboriginal Land Tribunal in a land claim notes, and I quote, present levels of utilisation of these parks by visitors is, by Department of Environment and Heritage estimates, very low. Of particular relevance to this question, relatively few vehicles use the difficult and very rough access tracks into the Cape Bowen and Cape Melville sectors of the parks. At present, it takes anything from 10 to 12 arduous hours to travel from Hope Vale to Cape Melville. A successful outcome to the claim and the realisation of the claimant's wishes to establish outstations and other infrastructural developments on the park would require at least some upgrading of these access tracks. Various scientists and national park interest groups asserted, again without any reliable evidence, that native species of fauna were endangered by Aboriginal use, even traditional use, of these areas for hunting. Hunting and gathering, for instance, was not permitted in any national park or protected area. In 1991, the late poet and conservationist Judith Wright McKinney took the conservationists to task for their attitudes to Aboriginal use of these areas that had once been their uncontested homelands. She was a founding member of the Wildlife Preservation Society of Queensland and had worked tirelessly for 29 years as a member, becoming its patron, until in 1991 she resigned in protest at the Society's opposition to Aboriginal land rights. The Age newspaper reported, in an open letter to WPSQ's 1,600 members, Mrs. Wright McKinney condemns the Society for being one of the chief opponents of Aboriginal land rights in Queensland. "I must disassociate myself completely from any organisation opposed to land rights, and I therefore have no option but to resign the patronship," she wrote. And the article goes on to say that in Queensland, environmentalists are bitterly divided over the Goss government's recently introduced land rights legislation because it allows Aborigines to claim ownership of national parks. The row threatens to spread nationally, with the Australian Conservation Foundation under fire from some members over its pro-land rights stance. The WPSQ and some other conservation groups, particularly in North Queensland, have adopted policies strongly opposing Aboriginal control of national parks and a legislative provision allowing Aborigines to hunt within their borders. Mrs. Wright McKinney disagreed. Knowing that the Environmental and Wilderness Campaign Associations and Societies provided a convenient Trojan horse for local racists, and that in any case they would not accept the simple argument that Aboriginal people are members of the human species and it had inhabited this area, shaping its biogeography for thousands of years, I turned to the historical record to find more recent evidence of human impact in the Cape. It was Professor Geoffrey Bolton's account of the white settlement of Cape York Peninsula that provided a wealth of evidence to refute the claims of the campaigners that sold the dream of a pristine state of nature to a gullible public. His detailed blow-by-blow account in 1,000 miles away of each lease, each grant of land to the settlers who imported herds of cattle, the gold rushes, and the diggers' insatiable demand for gold and meat is proof enough that this was no wilderness untouched by human intervention. Not wild, not pristine, except in its most inaccessible mountain jungles where even the sun does not penetrate, but a savage frontier whose battlefields are well known to its inhabitants, the Palmer River, Battle Camp, and hundreds more. The frontier conflict resulted in heavy casualties on both sides, and a history of frontier expansion of white settlement, often supported by executive actions by colonial and state governments, aimed at depopulating the newly opened lands. Bolton claimed North Queensland is undoubtedly the most successful example in the British Commonwealth of settlement in the tropics by Europeans. This initial success was serendipitous, coinciding as it did with the rise of the cotton price during the American Civil War, which stopped the export of cotton from the United States of America, and with the improving sugar price following the abolition of slavery in 1833. The drastic reduction of the Aboriginal population of North Queensland soon followed as a result of vigilante violence and enforced removal of populations. The spread of squatting in North Queensland, which had reached Charters Towers, was checked by the 1866 slump and from 1872 began anew. Bolton points out that from 1872, a number of new cattle stations were formed west and south of Charters Towers, but the main trend of pastoral expansion was northwards to administered settlements. or northwards. Sorry. He also pointed out that the gold rush at the Palmer River sent cattle prices to an average of £10 a head, and almost before the wet season of 1874 was over, mobs of cattle from the more northerly properties were pioneering the stock routes to raw new mining camps, where butchers outrivalled even the publicans in quick profits. The opening of the Hodgkinson, the revival of the Etheridge, the growth of the sugar industry and ports all created new demands. His history was commissioned by the North Queensland Local Government Association in 1956, and he delivered to his clients an economic history about the occupation by the early white settlers of a vast area from the late 1800s to the early 20th century. Because he detailed the stations and the settlers in his narrative of events, now it reads as a catalogue of land grabs, as in the following. Between 1873 and 1877, Greenvale, Kashmir and Gunawarra stations were carved from outlying blocks of the Valley of Lagoons, and Kangaroo Hills and Christmas Creek were formed on its borders. Meanwhile, Hand's discoveries and the Palmer Rush were attracting squatters to the country beyond. On the western side of the peninsula, the formation of Rotham Park in 1873 was followed by the occupation of much of the Lower Mitchell, in several instances by pastoralists from the Bowen district. The Palmer Rush attracted from 1874 several graziers hopeful of supplying the Maytown and Cooktown markets. Prospecting journeys by James Venture Mulligan in 1874 and 1875 drew attention to the lands on the Upper Mitchell, which were first occupied by James Fraser in 1876. The next year saw John Atherton overlanding with his family to take up Emerald End near the present town of Mareeba. His run included a tableland, then almost impenetrably scrub-covered, to which his name was given. Close on his heels came George Clark, one of the discoverers of Charters Towers, to claim for Frank Stubley, one of the new magnates of that golden city, much of what has since been known as the Evelyn Tableland. As he explained, the land grabs were driven by demand for new grazing lands. By 1880, many stations in the longer settled portions of North Queensland were becoming stocked to the limit of their capacity. These rushes brought thousands of unruly men to the region. News of their dispossession of Aboriginal land and largely unrecorded violence and depredations committed against the Aboriginal population must have filtered northwards, with fleeing Aboriginal people seeking refuge with their kinsmen in the uncolonised areas. As Bolton chronicles, for latecomers, land remained beyond the Palmer and the Mitchell on the Cape York Peninsula. He wrote, "Patchy in quality, inadequately explored, far away from good markets, the peninsula was inhabited by the tribes whose spearsmen had hounded Kennedy, harassed the Jardines, and wounded during the expedition of 1879 the geologist Logan Jack." He observed, "The bad treatment had confirmed the peninsula tribes in their hostility by the time the pastoralists arrived, and the conquest of the area was full of difficulties." He cited the Legislative Assembly, votes and proceedings of 1888 in relation to settler views following the bloody excesses of the Palmer River Gold Rush. There were serious drawbacks arising from the presence of a copper-coloured race of natives who are fierce and warlike, very treacherous, and have no more fear of a bullet than a spear. They will show fight in the face of odds and seem to be perfectly indifferent to the chances of being shot. From Cooktown to the inland goldfields along the Palmer River, 20,000 gold seekers who had arrived by 1875 were regularly attacked by Aborigines. The whole country was teeming with hostile blacks, and attacks on travellers and spearing of horses and cattle were of daily occurrence. It was also reported that the black avengers of the native police wreaked havoc. Political scientist and historian C.D. Rowley observed that the Queensland colony was hard won from its Aboriginal peoples by military means. He described the native police at some length in The Destruction of Aboriginal Society. Of the purpose of this military force, he wrote, "The final bankruptcy of frontier policy produced the traditions and the practices of the native police. White officers in charge of Aboriginal troopers had substantial independence of the local magistracies and operated in accordance with the tradition of the punitive expedition, which was common enough in establishing colonies. The use of group punishments in retaliation for murders and stock killings had clearly become a standard procedure. officers and Aboriginal troopers were mounted and armed. It was this volume of his trilogy on the fate of Aboriginal peoples in Australia that inspired a new generation of historians in the 1970s to re-examine the assumption of Aboriginal passivity that had permeated the conventional histories of Australia. The native police had become the main instrument of Aboriginal administration, he wrote, making it possible for the settlers to spread quickly into new areas without heavy stock losses. In Queensland, the Aboriginal seems to have come closer than hitherto to true guerrilla warfare. Thus, Queensland frontier policy came close to the alternative of complete conquest before introduction of the rule of law. He observed there was confusion between a state of war and the assumption that Aborigines were subject to the law. By the 1870s, the native police were led by officers influenced in the execution of their duty by unnatural ferocity. The native police offered a perfect niche for the sadist, he wrote, a fact which he thought provoked the state of war on this frontier. The continued striking at the heart of Aboriginal social order on the occasions of large assemblies made dangerous and difficult the renewal of social ties and the enforcement of the sanctions on which Aboriginal society depended. This in turn must have increased the desperation of the influential men and probably helped to provoke resistance on a scale resembling guerrilla warfare. The size of the native police force was never over 250 men. Mostly it was between 100 and 200, but firepower made a larger force unnecessary. The biggest extensions were made necessary by the gold rushes of the early 70s, Charters Towers, the Palmer, Cape River, Mount Morgan, Etheridge, Ravenswood, Normanby, Broughton River, all had to be protected. By this time, the Aboriginal resisted as far as he could all newcomers, even the miners, who had the protection of numbers and were not competing for the grasslands. The press was referring to a sickening, brutal war of races. The Aborigines of the Palmer River area, where the gold rush had begun in 1875, put up a more stubborn armed resistance than anywhere in Australia, maintaining a guerrilla-type campaign for 7 years at the cost of hundreds of lives, Raleigh wrote. In the settled districts, the work of the native police force was being handed over to the Queensland police, assisted by Aboriginal trackers, while the native police were able to concentrate on spreading civilisation in the northern and western regions. Their methods had incited a war that the settlers doubted they could win. In 1880, the newspaper, The Queensland, lending its column to some of these protests, stated that in Cape York, Aboriginal resistance had been intensified by police methods, that either new methods should be used or settlement must be delayed till the work of extermination is completed. Farmers in the settled areas, such as in the sugarcane growing areas of Mackay, demanded the protection and employment of Aborigines because of the shortage of white labourers, with their exodus to the goldfields in the north. Their petition foreshadowed the legislation of indentured labour conditions for Aborigines in 1897. And I quote, "Aboriginal remnants have provided labour for the sugar plantations useful enough to rouse interest in their possibilities. Probably they were at least as efficient as many of the Pacific Islanders brought in as indentured labour." A commission of inquiry reported in terms that established a new meaning for the term protection, terms that eventually became the provisions of the legislation that regulated the administration of native affairs during the following century. Raleigh summarised their findings. The commissioners reported with tolerable unanimity on the rapidity of decrease in numbers. The commissioners were yet of opinion that Aboriginal labour, especially for short terms of service, might be far more generally and profitably employed than it has hitherto been the case. The parliamentary debate in 1884 on the Native Labourers Protection Bill was a good indication of how far professed morality in a settler democracy can be moulded by economic interest and the need to cover up awkward facts. The technique of extending control had not changed much, Raleigh wrote. Of Cape York, Raleigh wrote, the last frontiers had been breached by settlement, by miners and by sugar planters as well as pastoralists. Successful miners in the Charters Towers area invested their earnings in the pastoral industry after 1870. Graziers moved into Cape York Peninsula with the prospect of new markets for meat following the gold rush to the Palmer River. There were the same stories of murdered settlers, of punitive expeditions which shot the wrong tribesmen, including women and children, of Aborigines in times of drought reduced by the destruction of game to emaciation and starvation. The stories were to continue in Cape York Peninsula till the end of the century. But of the squatters, Bolted noted their condition as men of great hardiness but little capital. This is what he wrote. On sparsely stocked and unimproved country, these nomadic battlers held the land by a tenure scarcely more secure than that of the Aborigines themselves, especially during the dry season. Conflict was frequent, and cattle and horses were killed in some numbers. Two squatters in the Cowan district were fatally speared, and as late as 1888, Watson of Maluna met his death during an attack on a neighbouring station. He summarised the situation in this way. There were countermeasures, of course, but the Aborigines were still unsubdued in some corners of the peninsula at the turn of the century. Perhaps the least offensive countermeasure was the imposition of a formal curfew on Aborigines in February 1885, banning them from Cooktown after dark. Here there were strong feelings, he wrote, against the natives, aroused partly by continued raids on the properties of neighbouring selectors and tribal fights in the streets of the town itself. He reports that a vigilante group had taken revenge on a group who were almost certainly the wrong Aborigines. The general situation for Aborigines near the centres of white settlement was starvation. And he wrote, change came most drastically. On the goldfields in particular, they often suffered considerable distress for want of their traditional sources of food. The famine from 1877 to 1879 in the Hodgkinson River District caused great suffering, and so did too did the drought on the Etheridge from 1888 to 1889. The natives were left, Bolton wrote, very emaciated and in many instances starving. The squatters faced a labour shortage as station hands deserted for the goldfields, and they turned to Aboriginal labour despite the bitter past. After 1880, when the Queensland government ruled against the employment of Pacific Islanders on properties more than 30 miles from the coast, the need for Aboriginal labour became greater. But, as Bolton notes, the taming of the Aborigines did not end the squatters' problems. As the tribes dwindled, their hiding places among the basalt ridges became the resort of marauders of a different kind. Cattle duffing had gone on almost as long as there had been cattle stations in Queensland, and many had come to regard it as a trifling offence. A Brands Act was passed in 1871, introducing a system of registering stock. The measure failed to prevent cattle theft by white men. In 1880, North Queensland cattle numbers were estimated at 450,000, almost three times the 1874 figure. And the following years saw rapid increases. Dry years followed in 1884 to 5 and 1888 to 9, and the rate of growth slowed. But after 1889, the numbers grew again quickly. In 1894, the numbers of cattle reached 1,400,000, a peak which has never been exceeded, nor has the region bettered its record of pasturing in that year, Bolton noted. Whereas in 1875, the proportion of cattle from North Queensland in the total Queensland herd had been little more than 1 in 9, by 1894 it was nearly 1 in 5. The cattle industry, especially in Cape York, could not sustain these successes as droughts, cyclones, lack of facilities for shipping and other transport difficulties, and variable herd quality as a result of inbreeding contributed to its decline in economic importance thereafter. Bolton's account was positive nevertheless. So by 1890, the Australian pastoral tradition was firmly established in the Queensland tropics, virtually unaltered by distance or climate. Once the unsuitability of the area for sheep had been recognised, it had not been necessary to resort to coloured labour for the northern pastoral industry. It must have seemed in 1890 that North Queensland had gone a considerable way to fulfilling the hopes of its pastoral pioneers in becoming the support of a flourishing community of resident owners. The wealth and population of North Queensland were chiefly derived from the mining and sugar industries. He concluded this chapter entitled Squatters and Aborigines, 1870 to 1890, with the following wry epitaph. Some there were who regretted that the white man's penetration of the country had caused such hostility and wrought such destruction among the natives. Most authorities agreed, however, that the Aborigines were a dying race. They were to be clothed and fed and might make themselves useful around the stations to the best of their ability. But as the world evolved, an inferior race had to give way to those who were better able to develop the land and its resources. Such was the thought of the times. And in truth, the Aborigines who lived under the paternalism of a North Queensland cattle station were not, in 1890, the least fortunate of their race. About that, he was right. With settler colonisation established on the cattle stations and in the few towns, the fate of many of the Aboriginal peoples of Cape York Peninsula was in the hands of protectors whose purpose was to bring the Aboriginal population under a strict regime of control. The controlled institution, Rowley wrote, on the distant reserve was inevitable once a genuine concern with Aboriginal welfare developed. Bolton's view that the process of Western economic progress is the justification for other consequences reminded Rowley of the frontiers in Africa, where similar kinds of expansion were being justified on the same grounds. Lord Lugard had given the process the respectability of colonial doctrine in the theory of the dual mandate that held that the colonial power should develop an area for the Indigenous people and the world. So much for the wilderness that the environmental campaigners thought they had discovered 100 years later. The region had been a prized and productive part of the colony and a war zone.
Marcia Langton delivering the 2013 Geoffrey Bolton Lecture here on Big Ideas on RN and online. She says the dream of a pristine state of nature on Cape York has been used to drive Aboriginal people off their land. And here she looks at how this has continued today.
In the 20th and 21st centuries, the conflict over the new wilderness ensued. 100 years later, it was not the cattlemen, but environmental campaigners seeking to dispossess the descendants of the people who had fought the graziers of Bolton's history. Guns had been replaced with ideas, some no less dangerous than the bullets of the frontier. The stated concern of elders for the ecological welfare of their estates directly contrasted with the assertion of environmental campaigners, fishermen, white landowners, and government officials that Aboriginal ownership presented a threat to the conservation of these areas. However, by 1992, following the High Court decisions in the Koowarta case and the Mabo No. 2 case, and with the passage of the Native Title Act in the Commonwealth Parliament, rapid changes in the recognition of Aboriginal rights diminished the power of the state over the lives of Aboriginal people, and the moral absolutism of the environmentalist non-government organisations became less effective and influential on government policy and administration of Crown lands, or so I thought at the time. It seemed that it was no longer possible for Aboriginal people to be easily dispossessed on environmental conservation grounds in order to preserve a range of tracts of special ecological significance on Cape York Peninsula. It became necessary for environmental organisations to seek alliances with Aboriginal organisations and traditional owners of the highly regarded areas of natural values. The Australian Conservation Foundation took the initiative in this regard, although the peace accord they settled was short-lived. Out of this conciliatory relationship, there developed the idea of the sustainable use and conservation of the Cape's natural and cultural values. The idea was expressed in a negotiated agreement, the Cape York Heads of Agreement, signed by authorised representatives of the Cape York Land Council on behalf of the traditional owners, the Australian Conservation Foundation, and the Cape York Cattlemen's Association. This historic agreement, signed in February 1996 by pastoralists, Aboriginal people and environmentalists on future land use on Cape York Peninsula, was an acknowledgement and affirmation by all parties of the past and ongoing Aboriginal occupation and use of the region, while simultaneously guaranteeing pastoralist security in relation to native title under a range of agreed conditions. Moreover, overlaying the whole agreement, stakeholders affirmed and committed themselves to ongoing negotiations aimed at achieving sustainable land management practices while maintaining high conservation values. The agreement was negotiated in the belief that the foundations for the future of Cape York Peninsula land use should be grounded in the recognition by respective stakeholders of one another's rights, aspirations and responsibilities. As an example of the efforts made to negotiate settlements in the spirit of this understanding, the Land Council and traditional owners negotiated the settlement of the purchase of the Starkey pastoral lease with the Queensland Government, an agreement which allocated two-thirds of the Starkey lease area as a national park and the involvement of the Yimmatthir traditional owners in the management of the park. Cape York is part of the ecological heritage of the whole nation, said Noel Pearson at the time, and that heritage can only benefit by the return of the traditional owners to their role as custodians of their country. The remaining third of the Starkey lease area was transferred to Aboriginal freehold title. The traditional owners opposed the setting aside of a mining reserve in Starkey until a compromise was reached, limiting the reserve to 15 years. Following this land settlement and the cultural, economic and conservation balance it achieved, the traditional Aboriginal owners purchased other land across the Cape and were successful in obtaining many of the very same areas of which Professor Bolton had written some 20 years earlier. They continued to allocate areas for nature conservation as well as their own traditional residential and cultural purposes and their economic futures. Aboriginal traditional owners are now major landholders in the Cape and have brought modern innovations to both pastoral use planning and conservation practices. Indeed, rather than tabula rasa, here were powerful ways of knowing the world and caring for the places and beings in it. And rather than pristine wilderness, landscapes degraded by decades of cattle grazing and wildfires, ignited by careless tourists and pig hunters. At this time, the principal campaign goal of the key environmental organisations was to markedly increase the area gazetted as national parks in the belief that this land use category provided the best means of protecting the natural environments of Queensland. To achieve more conservation areas, they targeted Aboriginal lands. The ACF strategy of negotiating with local representatives or local residents represented a radical departure from the urban-based politics of the environmental movement. Since then, the Aboriginal people of the region have tightened their grip on their ancestral lands, purchasing former pastoral leases and undertaking land management and planning programs. Objective evidence of detrimental impacts by Aboriginal landowners would be required both by the courts and the critical public should an environmental group seek again to dispossess them or hinder their claims to ancestral land with the purpose of creating national parks. The scientific community could not claim, after the report by Balkanoo Development Corporation to the National Reserve System study, that Aboriginal use of fire is not a continuing tradition in the area, and nor could they support the unsubstantiated claims by environmentalists about the impact of Aboriginal fire use. Moreover, since the conflicts of the early 1990s, scientists have sought to collaborate with these Aboriginal bodies and to obtain privileged access to the landscapes of the traditional owners. Yet even the Conservation Foundation, or Australian Conservation Foundation, once the voice of reason in these developments, has since adopted the ill-informed and inappropriate stance of the Wilderness Society and supported the suppression of Aboriginal interests when it advocated for the Wild Rivers Act, which was enacted by the Bligh government in 2004. The Newman government later repealed it. But for the Wilderness Society urban-based ideologues, the gazettal of Three Rivers and their entire catchment areas in Cape York were prized acquisitions that they had lobbied for over many years. Notwithstanding interventions by Cape York leaders and representatives over several years that arrested the Wild Rivers proposals at various points, the scheme went from bad to worse in its implications for Aboriginal landowners. The government announcement of three declared rivers actually obscured the detail. 13 rivers were included in the basins and catchments of these three named rivers. They were added to the original notion of protecting rivers. High preservation zones were announced in areas that were not even part of the proposal that was put out for public discussion. Areas of land that were not part of the original proposal for these rivers had been added to the complete surprise of those involved in the consultation process. Accused by the Wilderness Society of opposing the protection of rivers, Noel Pearson, a traditional owner of the relevant areas in his own right and director of Cape York Partnerships and the Cape York Institute for Policy and Leadership, expressed the view on behalf of the traditional owners that the protection of the rivers is a high priority for the Aboriginal people of Cape York. He said, "When it comes to the protection of rivers, there's absolutely no disagreement on our part that those rivers should remain in the way that they've been managed by Aboriginal people for thousands of years and for the past 200 years. Cape York Peninsula hosts the most pristine rivers in this country, and all of those rivers, bar a few, are on Aboriginal land. Now that says everything about the stewardship of the traditional owners, of the rivers on their land." The traditional owners believe and are insulted by the presumption that the legislation will protect the rivers against the interests of Aboriginal people for whom the peninsula is their homeland. Pearson and other traditional owners agree with reasonable restrictions to protect the river basins. We want the rivers protected, he said. Our fathers and grandfathers looked after those rivers. The reason why they're pristine is because they've been under continuous Aboriginal ownership. And now we face this ridiculous prospect that the Wilderness Society can make political deals with politicians that say the Aboriginal people have looked after these rivers for the past 200 years and for many millennia before that, but now we're going to take over responsibility for it and take over their responsibility. Another of Pearson's objections was that the terms of the Cape York Heads of Agreement, an agreement endorsed by the Gosse Queensland Government, had been breached in the Wild Rivers Act, which set out, in Pearson's belief, the terms of a subsequent agreement between the Wilderness Society and the government led by Premier Anna Bligh. Pearson cited the long history of negotiated settlements with the Queensland Government, which involved significant compromises by traditional owners of Cape York Peninsula, including his own clan group, to share their land on a 50-50 basis for conservation purposes. He said, "My conservation credentials long precede the Wilderness Society. We've been responsible for negotiating many millions of hectares of additional national parks in Cape York Peninsula. My own father's father's country was the first national park to be agreed in Cape York Peninsula back in 1993. I was the one, together with my family, who surrendered our land in the Starkey pastoral holding to the Gosse government in a deal that saw part of the land being set aside for Aboriginal people and part of the land set aside as Aboriginal-owned national park. And my own family's land was actually in the national park area. So my own inheritance is actually tied up in national park that is now 15 years old. We've negotiated national parks in the Starkey area and right throughout Cape York Peninsula. One of the principles that we established with the Gosse government in the early 90s was the principle of a 50-50 deal that wherever there was a national park created, the rest of the land, the other 50%, would be set aside as Aboriginal land. And now what Lyndon Schneider and the Wilderness Society are doing is saying, thank you very much for the 50% national park. Now we want to create a kind of quasi-national park over the 50% that was set aside as Aboriginal land. And, you know, they've broken away from the balance that we sought to achieve under the old Cape York Heads of Agreement. Not satisfied with a 50-50 deal, they want a 99% deal, and unfortunately we cannot agree with that. After 18 years of restituting a just proportion of the land area of Cape York Peninsula to its traditional owners, more than 70% of the land gained had been lost in a moment when Premier Bligh agreed to the Wild Rivers proposition of the Wilderness Society. In the context of Cape York, some conservationists argue that the only sustainable types of activity are those that preserve the ecological values of the region. This is an extreme interpretation of the concept of sustainability, which conventionally encompasses three tenets: environment, economy, and equity. These tenets are viewed along a continuum, where meeting the needs of the present does not compromise the ability of future generations to meet their own needs. As set out in the Brundtland Report in 1987, at the heart of the equity issue is that mainstream society has had the benefit of developing its economy at significant cost to the environment, but is now seeking increased control over privately held land of conservation value, such as Indigenous land on Cape York. The conservation economy will therefore represent nothing more than the residual opportunity for Indigenous people after other rights to their land have been weakened or taken. Perversely, the Wild Rivers Act had the effect of weakening Indigenous property rights on Cape York to the point where the potential for Indigenous people to benefit from emerging markets for carbon and biodiversity were also negated. The planning of the Aboriginal agencies in Cape York Peninsula for the long-term future of the Aboriginal populations had been ignored by the government in its hasty gazettals. Pearson has explained that only Aboriginal plans for economic development were limited and not those of other interests. Other objections concern the inadequate scientific assessments in the Declaration of Cape York Rivers, especially the lack of objective and transparent science on which the state based their decisions as to which rivers qualified as wild rivers and which did not. rather than use the assessment criteria recommended by reputable scientists and the scientific information in the nomination documents, the state declared almost every basin and catchment on Cape York as a wild river. There was no transparent or consistent method of river assessment used and no field assessment. The lack of consideration of aquatic biota, such as fish, seems a fundamental flaw. The only river basin on Cape York with greater than 80% of its stream length undisturbed, that is the criteria that qualified it as a wild river, is the Jardine River. The Archer, Wenlock and Stewart did not qualify on the grounds of degree of disturbance, were declared in any case. Scientists such as Stein and his colleagues who study the status of wild rivers proposed a very different approach involving stewardship in acknowledgement of the fact that most of the undisturbed rivers are on private lands, including Aboriginal land and native title determination areas. Their definition noted, "The definition of a wild river adopted for the project emphasised the absence of alteration to the biological, hydrological and geomorphological processes associated with river flow by modern or colonial society. Aboriginal land management certainly had some impact on catchments and rivers, however, it is thought to be relatively minor compared with European influence. Note this definition considers only alterations to the natural processes affecting river flow and not issues of remoteness or aesthetic naturalness. This contrasts with the concept of wilderness as embodied in Australia's National Wilderness Inventory, in which remoteness is an essential attribute of wilderness. Thus, a river flowing through areas with high wilderness value may have low wild river value if its headwaters are significantly disturbed. Conversely, a river close to a major settlement may have high wild river values if its catchment is intact. Their approach was to recommend incentives for landholders to adopt the wild river management guidelines, an approach which Aboriginal traditional owners had long ago taken. Another approach recommended was the River and Wetland Health Assessment National Framework. The Queensland Government ignored the science and followed the approach of the Wilderness Society and declared every river a wild river. Fortunately for the Aboriginal traditional owners of Cape York and for the scientists who valued rigorous evidence in relation to the status and protection of rivers, the Act was repealed by the Newman Government. Yet the lesson of this history is that we Aboriginal people cannot take for granted our hard-won legal rights, nor rely on the public and our governments to respect them. These events show how easy it is for ideologues to persuade the gullible of the unconscionable. After all that we know from the historical record, this should not surprise us, however. And yet, how ironic it is that a parallel can be drawn with recent events in this state, in which environmental campaigners pitted themselves against the majority of traditional owners seeking to achieve a similar balance of their economic and natural conservation interests to those achieved by Noel Pearson and his fellow traditional owners in Cape York Peninsula. It behoves us to be mindful of history and to demand rigorous evidence. The failure of so many to do so has caused Aboriginal people to suffer the impact of environmental racism and a new kind of lack of regard for our future. Thank you.
The resonance of history, archives, past decisions and Indigenous disadvantage. That was the title of this year's Geoffrey Bolton Lecture. The speaker was Professor Marcia Langton AM, Foundation Chair in Australian Indigenous Studies at the University of Melbourne. And that's it for Big Ideas tonight. Thanks for listening. If you'd like to comment on the program, you can do so on our website, abc.net.au/radionational. Just find your way to the Big Ideas page. Tomorrow on Big Ideas, a eulogy for the printed book. Hope you can join me then. I'm Paul Barclay. Bye for now.
On the health report, dementia getting up your nose. There's a smell about Alzheimer's disease. The toxic factors that might influence Alzheimer's disease may be getting in through your nose, and your nose may be the way to diagnose the disease early. Plus, a radical diet for epilepsy, and that hormones and the brain study we promised last week and didn't deliver. And if you didn't hear that health report with me, Norman Swan, why not download a podcast from RN's website?